You're handed a microscopic vial of dust.
Right, just a tiny pinch of crushed bone.
Yeah, just dust. And you're told to use it to solve, like, the oldest murder mystery on Earth.
No pressure, right.
Exactly. I mean, you need to pull out the family history of the person it belonged to, map their social networks, determine their overall health, and ultimately figure out how their entire species completely vanished from the planet.
It's a tall order for a few milligrams of powder.
It really is. Usually, when you're looking at a forensic cold case, you have the luxury of, a crime scene or a weapon, or at least a relatively intact body.
You certainly don't expect the primary evidence to be a few specks of degraded powder that has been sitting in a damp cave for 40,000 years.
But step into the world of ancient human history, and that is exactly the puzzle scientists are currently solving. They are reconstructing the incredibly complex lives and the ultimate fate of the Neanderthals using literal dust.
It sounds like science fiction, I know, but the methodologies we're looking at today represent a monumental leap in
Oh,
paleogenetics.
for sure.
We are moving far beyond just categorizing old bones based on their physical shape. We're accessing the invisible molecular blueprints hidden deep inside the mineral matrix of those bones.
And that is our mission for this deep dive. You and I are going to explore how scientists are pulling off this forensic miracle.
It really is a miracle.
We're going to unpack how they extract ancient DNA from heavily degraded, contaminated fragments. We'll see how they use that genetic code to physically piece together shattered skeletons.
Actually, overriding and correcting the physical reconstructions made by archaeologists over a century ago.
Which is wild.
Yeah.
And finally, we will explore how this genetic data completely overturns the dominant narrative of the Neanderthal extinction.
So the foundation of our deep dive is a phenomenal study published in Nature, led by researcher Alba Bossoms Mesa.
Right.
This paper provides the highest resolution picture we have ever seen of the genetic diversity of late Neanderthals in northwestern Europe, specifically focusing on present-day Belgium and France.
And we have some other insights too, right?
Yeah, we are also looking closely at insights from Professor Marie Ceresi regarding a critical Neanderthal specimen from a French site called Les Côtes. That specimen serves as a really vital anchor point for understanding the geographic spread of these populations.
Okay, let's unpack this, because
Yep.
I am genuinely stuck on the physical reality of step one.
Getting the DNA.
Yeah. How do you pull a reliable genetic sequence from a biological sample that is 50 millennia old? We are talking about organic material. If an apple falls off a tree in my backyard, it decomposes into soil in, like, a matter of months.
Exactly.
How does DNA, this incredibly fragile double helix, survive 50,000 years of glaciation, moisture, and microbial decay?
Well, the short answer is for the vast majority of cases, it doesn't.
Right.
When we look at Pleistocene remains bones from this specific Ice Age epoch, the baseline expectation is that the DNA is entirely destroyed. The degradation process is just relentless.
So what actually happens to it in the ground?
The moment an organism dies, its cellular repair mechanisms shut down. Then water starts breaking the bonds in the DNA backbone through a process called hydrolysis, and oxygen attacks the chemical bases themselves.
So the molecule is essentially being chemically shredded by the environment.
Shredded is the perfect word. Ancient DNA doesn't survive as those long, continuous strands you see in textbook illustrations.
Right, the nice, neat little ladders.
Yeah, those are gone. It survives as incredibly short, highly degraded fragments, usually bound tightly to the hydroxyapatite, which is the dense mineral component of the bone.
Okay.
To even see if there was anything left to work with, the researchers in the study started with initial shotgun sequencing on 175 different DNA libraries from these remains.
Now, shotgun sequencing is essentially a blind net, right?
That's a good way to put it, yeah.
You dissolve a piece of the sample and sequence absolutely every fragment of genetic material present, regardless of what it belongs to.
It is a completely untargeted approach. You just
Yeah.
want to see the total composition of the genetic material in the sample, and the results from that initial screening highlight the sheer scale of the problem here.
What did they find?
Out of everything they sequenced, the median amount of endogenous DNA, meaning the actual authentic Neanderthal genetic material, was less than 1%.
Wait, less than 1%.
Less than 1%.
That means 99% of the data is just noise. What makes up that 99%?
A massive amount of it is environmental DNA. Soil microbes, bacteria, ancient fungi that colonized the bone thousands of years ago.
That makes sense.
But the most problematic component by far is us, modern human DNA.
Oh, because these bones have been handled since the 19th century.
Precisely. Some of these samples exhibited modern human contamination levels up to 90.3%.
Wow.
You have to imagine the history of these objects. An antiquarian in the 1880s digs them out of a cave with a pickaxe. A museum curator in the 1920s sneezes near them.
Right.
Decades of researchers handle them without gloves. Every single modern touch leaves behind millions of intact human cells.
And those modern cells completely swamp the tiny fraction of fragmented, degraded Neanderthal DNA still clinging to the inside of the bone.
Exactly. It essentially means scientists are putting a bone in a sequencing machine, and what they're actually studying is the DNA of a clumsy Victorian museum curator.
Well, the Neanderthal is just a ghost in the background.
Yes.
Okay, if the target is that vanishingly small and the modern contamination is that overwhelming, how do you even physically separate the two?
It requires an incredibly aggressive yet highly targeted extraction protocol. They don't just take a chunk of bone and drop it into a blender.
I would hope not.
They locate the densest possible areas of the bone fragments and use a precision dentistry drill to extract microscopic amounts of bone powder from the interior.
How much powder are we talking about?
We are talking about sample sizes ranging from just 1 to 57.1 milligrams of powder.
That is essentially a grain of sand.
It is a microscopic yield. And before they even attempt to extract the DNA from that powder, they have to chemically burn away the modern contamination sitting on the surface.
How do they do that without destroying the sample?
They put the powder through pretreatment baths using a sodium hypochlorite solution, which is essentially a highly concentrated bleach or specialized phosphate buffers.
Wait, if you are treating the sample with bleach, aren't you destroying the very DNA you're trying to study? I mean, bleach destroys organic material.
It does. And that is the calculated risk of the pretreatment. The hypochlorite wash oxidizes and destroys the exposed exogenous DNA on the surface of the bone powder, the curator's DNA.
Right, this stuff on the outside.
But because the ancient endogenous Neanderthal DNA is tightly bound within the dense hydroxycapatite mineral matrix of the bone itself, it is temporarily protected from the wash.
Oh, I see. It's like power washing the mud off a safe to get to the documents locked inside.
That is a highly accurate way to look at it, actually.
Okay, so the bleach cleans the outside. Then what?
Once they wash away the modern surface DNA, they dissolve the mineral matrix to release the ancient DNA. Then they use a specialized silica-based extraction protocol.
Silica, like sand.
Kind of. In the presence of certain chaotropic salts, DNA molecules undergo a chemical change that causes them to bind tightly to silica. The researchers use a centrifuge to force the solution through a silica membrane.
So it acts like a filter.
Yes. The tiny, fragmented ancient DNA sticks to the silica, and all the remaining chemical impurities, the broken down proteins, the dirt, they flow right through and are discarded.
So now you have a purified sample of tiny fragments.
Yes.
But you still have a massive problem. Modern humans and Neanderthals share the vast majority of our DNA. Even if you wash the bone, how do you absolutely prove that a specific tiny fragment of genetic code belongs to a 45,000-year-old Neanderthal, and not just a very short fragment from a modern human that somehow survived the bleach wash?
What's fascinating here is that the answer lies in the chemistry of decay. The researchers look for a specific, naturally occurring molecular signature called C-to-T deamination.
Deamination. Walk me through the mechanics of that.
Okay, so in the DNA code, the letters A, C, T, and G, the C, stands for cytosine.
Right.
Over tens of thousands of years, as the DNA fragment sits in the damp earth, water molecules attack the cytosine bases at the very ends of the broken DNA strands.
Because the ends are exposed.
Exactly. This hydrolysis reaction knocks an abelian group off the cytosine molecule. When that happens, the cytosine chemically transforms into uracil.
Uracil being a base normally found in RNA, not DNA.
You've got it. So when the researchers run this ancient degraded fragment through modern DNA sequencing machines, the machine doesn't know what to do with uracil in a DNA strand.
Oh, it gets confused.
Basically, yeah. So it reads it as a thymine, a T. This creates a highly specific observable pattern. At the extreme terminal ends of an ancient DNA fragment, you will see a massive spike where the letter C has been mistakenly read as a T.
It is a molecular timestamp. The damage itself becomes the authentication.
It really is. If a fragment doesn't have that C to T damage at the ends, it's too pristine. It must be modern contamination. It is the gold standard for proving antiquity in paleogenetics.
But there's an inherent contradiction there, isn't there?
How so?
Well, if you are deliberately hunting for damaged DNA, literally code, where the chemical structure has decayed so badly that a C reads as a T, how do you sequence an accurate genome?
Yeah.
If you use the typos to prove the book is old, aren't you just left with a book full of typos? How do you prevent that damage from totally corrupting your final sequence?
That is where the heavy lifting shifts from chemistry to bioinformatics. The analytical software they use is programmed to recognize the deamination pattern and essentially mask those damaged terminal bases.
It just ignores them.
Pretty much. The algorithm knows that the first and last few base pairs of a sequence are likely degraded, so it ignores them when reconstructing the actual genome. It relies on the pristine code in the middle of the fragments.
But ancient fragments are incredibly short to begin with, right? Sometimes only 30 or 40 letters long. If you ignore the ends, you are left with almost nothing. You would need millions of overlapping fragments to piece together a reliable sequence.
You do. You need massive targeted depth. And because shotgun sequencing is just a blind net that mostly pulls up environmental junk, they couldn't rely on it to get that depth.
So what did they do instead?
They deployed a custom hybridization capture panel called Archaic Plus.
Okay, how does a hybridization capture panel differ from shotgun sequencing?
Think of Archaic Plus like dropping millions of tiny, highly specific molecular magnets into a swimming pool full of trash.
I love that visual.
The researchers synthesize millions of RNA baits. These are short strands of genetic code that are complementary to roughly 2.3 million specific single nucleotide polymorphisms, or SNPs.
SNPs being specific points in the genome where a single letter differs between populations.
Right. And these specific SNPs are highly informative of Neanderthal variation. These RNA baits act as the magnets. They're introduced into the extracted DNA library.
And because DNA inherently wants to bind to its complementary sequence, these baits seek out and bind only to the specific Neanderthal fragments floating in the mixture.
Exactly. Then, using a chemical mechanism, the researchers physically pull those baits out of the solution, dragging the targeted ancient DNA with them and washing the rest of the environmental junk away.
That is an astonishing level of molecular engineering.
And it is devastatingly effective. By combining the hypochlorite washes, the silica extraction, the bioinformatics masking, and the Archaic Plus targeting, they achieved something remarkable.
What did they get?
For one specific individual from Goyet Cave in Belgium, a female they designated GN1, they didn't just get a handful of fragments, they recovered a high coverage genome. We were talking 22.4-fold coverage.
Meaning they read every single position in that entire genome an average of 22 times to verify it.
Yeah.
They took a specimen that started with less than 1% endogenous DNA, stripped away a century of modern contamination, bypassed the chemical degradation, and rebuilt a high-resolution complete genome.
It is a technical masterpiece. It gives us a biological ledger of this individual that is nearly as accurate as if we took a blood sample from her today.
What blows my mind is what they did next. Because once you possess that level of genetic resolution, you don't just use it to populate a spreadsheet.
No, you can do much more with it.
The researchers took this invisible molecular data and used it to physically correct the mistakes made by archaeologists over a century ago.
Right.
They use the genome as a key to literally reassemble the skeletons.
Yeah, and to fully appreciate why that was even necessary, we have to look at the history of these specific sites in the Meuse Basin in Belgium, particularly Goyet and Spy.
Why, what happened there?
The context of these excavations is pure chaos.
So we aren't talking about men in white suits with soft brushes meticulously recording the exact coordinate of every millimeter of soil.
Not at all. Many of these sites were originally excavated in the middle of the 19th century. Edouard Dupont excavated Goyet in 1868.
Wow, that early.
Yeah, and at the time, stratigraphy, the careful mapping of geological layers to establish a timeline, it was in its infancy. They used pickaxes, spades, and sometimes dynamite to clear caves.
Dynamite. You're kidding.
No, it was a very different time for archaeology.
Huh.
They threw the bones they deemed interesting into boxes and discarded the rest. So the context of where specifically in the ground a bone was found was entirely lost.
They just created a massive pile of disjointed puzzle pieces.
It gets worse, actually.
Oh, no.
At Goyet specifically, the fragmentation wasn't just caused by careless 19th century digging. There is undeniable evidence of anthropogenic modifications on the Neanderthal bones themselves.
Now, if you hear anthropogenic modifications, you might picture tool making or carving. But in this context, we are talking about cannibalism, aren't we?
We are. The researchers found clear percussion marks where the long bones had been intentionally smashed open to extract the marrow inside. There are also cut marks near the joints where muscle and tendons were deliberately stripped away by stone tools.
So, to summarize the crime scene, 40,000 years ago, these individuals were butchered and their bones were smashed into splinters.
Right.
Then, 150 years ago, early archaeologists dug them up with pickaxes, jumbled them all together in boxes, and sent them to museums.
And then those museum curators and early paleoanthropologists tried to reassemble them.
How could they possibly do that with a box of splinters?
They used morphology. They looked at the size, the shape, the curvature of the shattered fragments, and they tried to visually refit them, literally gluing pieces together to make museum displays.
Just eyeballing it.
Basically, if a fragment looked like a piece of a right tibia, a shin bone, and it seemed to fit the contour of another fragment, they assumed it was the same bone from the same individual.
It is entirely logical based on the tools they had. I mean, morphology was all they had.
True.
But this new study proves that the physical shape of the bone can lie.
It proves that morphological refitting in a highly fragmented assemblage is dangerously unreliable. The researchers used a specialized bioinformatics software called KIM32 to figure this out.
KIN32. What does that do?
This program is specifically designed to calculate the degree of genetic relatedness between different samples, even when the DNA coverage is very low.
How does KIN32 actually determine that mechanically?
It analyzes the allele frequencies at thousands of targeted points across the genome. If you take two fragments of bone, and the KIN32 analysis shows that their genetic variance is absolutely identical.
Meaning they carry the exact same specific mutations at the exact same frequencies across the entire sequence.
Exactly. If that happens, the statistical probability of them belonging to two different people drops to zero. They are the same person.
So they applied KIN32 to the museum assemblages from Belgium. What did they find?
They found profound errors in the physical reconstructions. For example, there were two specific bone fragments from Goyet designated Q3057 and Q374A1. Based on their morphology, experts had concluded that these pieces belonged to two completely different right tibias from two different individuals.
Okay.
But when the KIN32 software analyzed their DNA, they were genetically identical.
Here's where it gets really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
They were from the exact same bone of the exact same person.
Yes. The experts had fundamentally misclassified the physical fragments. This prompted the geneticists to go back to the drawing board. They sampled a third fragment, Q54 TAF, which had previously been associated with the first two.
And what did that show?
KIN32 revealed that this third piece perfectly matched a totally different genetic individual, whom they named GN2.
That is wild. The invisible genetic code completely overrode the physical structure.
It did.
It means you could be walking through a natural history museum looking at a beautifully reconstructed hominin leg bone in a glass case, and it might literally be glued together incorrectly with pieces from two different people who were cannibalized 40,000 years ago.
It's entirely possible. The same thing happened at the Spy Cave site. The researchers tested a right thigh bone, a femur known as Spy 8, and an upper third molar, a tooth known as Spy 94A.
Let me guess.
KIN32 proved that the tooth and the thigh bone unequivocally belong to the exact same adult male individual.
This feels like a paradigm shift for archaeology. I mean, if you cannot trust the physical shape and contour of a bone to tell you what it is or who it belongs to, does this mean paleoanthropology based solely on morphology is obsolete?
It doesn't make morphology obsolete, no. But it proves that in complex, highly fragmented scenarios, morphology cannot operate in a vacuum.
They have to work together.
Exactly. Genetics and paleoanthropology must be totally integrated moving forward. By using the DNA as the ultimate arbiter, the researchers were able to dismantle the flawed museum displays and accurately group the shattered fragments into verified, distinct biological individuals.
Like GN1, GN2, the Spy 94A8 male, and so on.
Right. They cleared the messy board.
And once you have accurately isolated the individuals, you can finally start looking at the population as a whole. How did these verified individuals relate to one another?
This is where the study fundamentally shifts our understanding of Neanderthal society. The genetic data completely shatters the stereotype of the isolated, lonely caveman huddled in a frozen wasteland.
That stereotype has driven the popular imagination for decades. The idea that Neanderthals lived in tiny, desperate family units entirely cut off from the rest of the world.
Right.
Where did that scientific assumption come from originally?
It came from the very first high-coverage Neanderthal genomes we were able to sequence, which came from the Altai region in Siberia, specifically specimens known as the Chagarskaya and Denisova 5 Neanderthals.
So the extreme eastern edge of the Neanderthal range.
Right. And the genetics of those Siberian populations painted a very bleak picture. They showed clear evidence of severe isolation and heavy inbreeding.
How do you see inbreeding in a genome?
The bioinformatic proof for this was the presence of long HBD tracks in their genomes.
HBD tracks. Homozygous by descent tracks. We need to define exactly what that means mechanically, because it is the linchpin for understanding their social structure.
Okay, so every individual inherits two copies of their genome, one from their mother, one from their father.
Right.
When you look at the sequence, if a long stretch of the DNA inherited from the mother is absolutely identical to the stretch inherited from the father, that region is homozygous.
Because they inherited the exact same genetic code from both sides of the family.
Yes, and the critical factor is the length of those identical stretches. When reproductive cells divide and combine over generations, a process called recombination constantly shuffles the DNA, breaking those identical stretches into smaller and smaller pieces.
It mixes the deck of cards.
Exactly. Therefore, if an individual's genome contains very long, unbroken homozygous tracks specifically, tracks longer than 10 centimorgans, it means the shuffling process hasn't had time to break them down.
I see.
It is definitive proof that the individual's parents shared a very recent common ancestor.
In other words, long HBD tracks equal recent severe inbreeding. Their parents were siblings, or first cousins, or an uncle and a niece.
Exactly. And the Altai Neanderthals were rife with these long tracks. The Denisova 5 Neanderthal, for instance, had a genome that indicated her parents were half-siblings.
Wow.
So the scientific community logically extrapolated, if this is what Neanderthal genetics look like, they must have lived in tiny, highly isolated groups forced into inbreeding just to survive the harsh Pleistocene environment.
But this new study focuses on the late Neanderthals in Western Europe, France, and Belgium. When they ran the HBD analysis on these individuals, what did the genome show?
It showed a completely different reality. When they looked at GN1, the high-coverage female from the Goyet Cave, she exhibited absolutely no excess of these long 10 centimorgan HBD tracks.
Her genome was free of the signature of recent inbreeding.
Completely.
Which means her parents were not closely related. But what about the local group at the Goyet site itself? Even if her parents weren't related, surely the individuals living and dying in that specific cave were an extended family.
That is what the researchers assumed. They used KIN32 to map the relatedness of all the distinct individuals they had identified from the Goyet fragments. The result was astonishing. None of the individuals at the site were close relatives, even up to the third degree.
Wait, no siblings, no parents and children, no cousins?
None. There was even a fragmented bone of a neonate boy, an infant found in the assemblage. When they cross-referenced his DNA with the adult females found in the cave, his mother was nowhere to be found.
That is tragic, but scientifically fascinating. They were just a diverse collection of unrelated individuals utilizing the same location. It completely breaks the model of the isolated family unit.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, it changes everything.
But if they aren't breeding within their own tiny caves, how broad is their network?
It was vast. The study maps a deep genetic connection that stretches across massive geographic distances. The individuals in Belgium shared a common ancestor with a Neanderthal found all the way in Croatia.
Croatia, that's huge.
Yeah, the Vindicia 33.19 specimen, who lived around 54,000 years ago. Furthermore, the specimen from La Côtes in France, studied by Professor Marie Soresi, acted as a genetic bridge, showing profound continuity between the Western populations and Central Europe.
This implies a level of connectivity that is almost hard to fathom. We are talking about prehistoric hominins moving across the European continent from France through Belgium into the Balkans.
It's an incredible distance.
Were they building roads? Did they have established trade networks where a Neanderthal from Paris would hike to Zagreb to find a mate?
Well, it is tempting to imagine a bustling prehistoric highway system, but the study suggests a more dynamic, environmentally driven mechanism.
Okay.
The connectivity was the result of episodic phases of regional openness in a broader framework of climatically driven population contraction and expansion.
Okay, that sounds incredibly dense. Break down the environmental reality of that for me.
Sure. We are talking about marine isotope stage 3. The climate was incredibly volatile. It wasn't a static ice age. There were sudden, rapid warming periods called Dansgaard-Ogiger events.
And what happens during those events?
During these warming pulses, the glaciers would retreat, the tundra would transform into open steppe and forest, and the massive herds of herbivores would expand their ranges.
And the Neanderthals, being apex predators, followed the food.
Precisely. As the environment opened up, previously isolated regional groups would expand their territories, following the game corridors. They would encounter other groups, intermingle, exchange genes, and then, when the climate rapidly cooled again and the ice advanced, those populations would contract back into southern refugia.
So it was a massive climate-driven pulse, the continent breathing in and out. And during those breaths, genetic information flowed from France to Croatia.
Exactly. It proves that these Western Neanderthals were not doomed, isolated stragglers. They possessed the population density, the mobility, and the social structure to maintain a large, interconnected, genetically healthy community.
Which brings us to the most massive, unavoidable paradox of this entire subject.
The extinction.
Right. If they were well-connected, if they possessed high genetic diversity, and if they were completely free of the severe inbreeding that plagued the eastern populations, why did they die?
It's the ultimate question.
For a long time, the prevailing biological consensus was that the Neanderthals were essentially doomed by their own DNA. This study directly puts that theory on trial.
It absolutely does. The scientific theory you are referring to is known as progressive genetic deterioration.
Explain the mechanism behind that theory. Why did scientists assume their genetics were deteriorating?
It is based on the mechanics of evolutionary population genetics. Compared to modern humans expanding out of Africa, Neanderthals generally had a much lower effective population size.
Okay.
In evolutionary biology, when a population size is small, a phenomenon called genetic drift becomes much stronger than purifying selection.
Let's define purifying selection really quick.
Purifying selection is the evolutionary filter that weeds out harmful mutations. In a massive population, if a purely negative mutation arises, say, a mutation that makes a bone slightly more brittle, the individuals with that mutation will be slightly less successful. They will leave fewer offspring.
And the sheer mathematical weight of the healthy population will eventually flush that mutation out of the gene pool.
Exactly. But in a small population, that math breaks down completely.
Because there aren't enough healthy individuals to outbreed the bad trait.
Right. In a small population, genetic drift, which is essentially random chance, takes over. A harmful mutation can accidentally become fixed in the population just through bad luck.
Okay, I follow you.
The hypothesis was that because Neanderthals had smaller populations, their purifying selection was weak. Therefore, over hundreds of thousands of years, they slowly accumulated a massive genetic load of these slightly harmful mutations. It was a slow biological decay that eventually pushed them over the edge into extinction.
It is a neat and tidy explanation. They just biologically faded away. Mm. But how do you possibly test the genetic load of a species that has been extinct for 40 millennia?
The researchers in the study utilized incredibly precise bioinformatics tools to measure the specific types of mutations occurring in the genomes of these final late Neanderthals and compared them to older early Neanderthals.
What metric did they use?
The primary metric they used was the PNPS ratio.
That is a critical metric, the ratio of missense mutations to synonymous mutations. For those trying to visualize this, a synonymous mutation is a typo in the genetic code that doesn't actually change the physical output.
Right.
If the DNA sequence spells out the word color with a U, C-O-L-O-U-R, it is technically a mutation, but the cell still reads it as the exact same color. The protein built by that gene is perfectly normal.
But a missense mutation, the PN in that ratio, is a typo that fundamentally changes the meaning. It alters the amino acid sequence, which changes the shape and function of the resulting protein.
These are the mutations that cause biological problems.
Exactly. So if the progressive genetic deterioration theory is correct, the researchers should have found a much higher ratio of harmful missense mutations in these late Neanderthals from France and Belgium compared to the older Neanderthals.
Their genetic load should be heavier.
Right.
So what does this all mean? What did the data actually show?
The PNPS ratio was completely stable. It did not increase.
The genetic load wasn't getting heavier at all.
It wasn't. And to ensure the finding wasn't a statistical anomaly, they deployed two other highly sophisticated conservation scoring algorithms, Polyfin2 and PhiloP.
What do those do?
These algorithms scan both the coding and non-coding regions of the genome, looking for shifts toward deleterious, harmful variants based on deep evolutionary conservation across primate species.
So they double and triple check the math.
Yes, and the finding was unanimous across all metrics. There was absolutely no significant difference in the genetic load between the early Neanderthals and these final late survivors.
Their heterozygosity, their genetic diversity, was rock solid right up to the end. I love the analogy of looking at a vintage car that has been completely destroyed. The genetic deterioration theory assumed the car eventually broke down and was abandoned because the engine slowly rusted away over decades.
Right, a slow death.
But this study is the mechanic opening the hood and discovering that the engine was pristine. It was running perfectly. The car didn't break down. It crashed into a brick wall at 60 miles an hour.
That is exactly what the data proves. Their extinction was not an inevitability driven by biological decay. They were genetically viable. So the question pivots entirely. What was the wall they crashed into?
The wall was us. Modern humans. We know that the biological engine of the Neanderthals was fine. We also know from the radiocarbon dates and molecular clocks generated in this study that at the exact same time these final Neanderthals were thriving in Western Europe, roughly between 49,000 and 840,000 years ago, early modern humans were rapidly expanding into the exact same territory.
Yes, the timing is undeniable.
What happened when they collided?
The archaeological context leaves absolutely zero doubt that they overlapped in time and space. Look at the site of Arcy-sur-Cure in France, which was analyzed in this study.
What's special about that site?
The researchers identified a Neanderthal specimen known as AR30 in an archaeological layer known as the Châtelperronian. Inside that exact same stratigraphic layer, previous excavations had recovered a modern human bone.
They were literally walking the same river valleys, utilizing the same cave systems at the same historical moment. It is the ultimate evolutionary collision.
He really is.
Now, basic biology and human nature dictate that if two closely related populations overlap, they're going to mix. We already know that modern humans carry Neanderthal DNA, so the critical question this study asked was, did these late Neanderthals carry modern human DNA?
To detect that, the bioinformatics team utilized a specialized software tool called AdmixFrog.
AdmixFrog. I have to say, geneticists are truly brilliant at molecular engineering and absolutely terrible at naming software. Archaic Plus, KIM32, AdmixFrog.
The names are definitely a bit eccentric.
How does a frog find human DNA in a Neanderthal genome?
It relies on a mathematical framework called the Hidden Markov model.
Okay, that sounds incredibly dense. How does a math equation see human DNA hiding inside a Neanderthal sequence? What is the algorithm physically looking for?
Think of the genome as a massive string of beads. A hidden Markov model calculates the probability of transitioning from one state to another along that string.
Okay.
The algorithm analyzes the sequence bead by bead. It knows the statistical frequency of specific mutations that are unique to modern humans and the frequency of mutations unique to Neanderthals. The software scans the late Neanderthal genome, constantly calculating the probability. Is this bead Neanderthal? Yes. Yeah. Next bead Neanderthal? Yes.
It is hunting for a stretch where the probability suddenly shifts, where a sequence of beads screams modern human.
Yes, it's looking for a cohesive block of foreign code. And the size of that block is critical. Because these late Neanderthals lived a maximum of maybe 500 generations after the first hypothetical interactions with expanding modern humans, the mathematics of recombination dictate that if interbreeding had occurred recently, the chunks of modern human DNA would still be relatively long and intact.
Right, because the deck of cards hasn't been shuffled enough times to break the chunks down.
Exactly. Specifically, the researchers were looking for tracks of modern human DNA longer than one centimorgan.
The centimorgan being a unit of genetic linkage that helps measure how much the DNA has been shuffled. If the mixing happened recently, the human chunk hasn't been sliced up by generation after generation of cell division, so it stays longer than one centimorgan.
You've got it.
What did AdmixFrog find?
It found absolutely nothing.
Right. Zero recent human DNA.
Zero. The researchers combed through the genomes of these late Neanderthals looking for those one centimorgan tracks of introgression, and they came up empty.
That's crazy.
The absolute longest tract of modern human DNA they found in any of these specimens was a minuscule 0.4 one centimorgans.
Which indicates what?
A tract that tiny is the result of ancient deep time interactions, perhaps hundreds of thousands of years prior, completely separate from this late Pleistocene encounter. Or it could simply be incomplete lineage sorting, meaning it's a tiny sliver of shared code retained from the ancient ancestor that both modern humans and Neanderthals evolved from.
But it is definitively not evidence of recent mingling.
Right. Not recent at all.
But wait, this creates an enormous contradiction. We know for an absolute prover fact that early modern humans in Eurasia did have recent Neanderthal ancestors.
We do.
If you look at the human fossil known as Oase 1 from Romania, or the modern human remains from the Bacho-Kiro cave in Bulgaria, their genomes contain massive long tracts of Neanderthal DNA. The geneticists proved that those specific modern humans had Neanderthal ancestors just 4 to 10 generations back in their family trees.
This raises an important question, doesn't it? You have hit on one of the most profound and perplexing mysteries in paleogenetics. This study highlights a massive, extreme asymmetry in the genetic record. The gene flow appears to be an entirely one-way street.
Neanderthal DNA flowed into the modern human population. But modern human DNA did not flow into the late Neanderthal population. Why?
The researchers proposed several hypotheses to explain this asymmetry. The first is a simple demographic imbalance. If the modern human populations expanding into Europe were vastly larger than the resident Neanderthal populations, the sheer mathematical weight of the human gene pool would swamp the interactions.
If a cup of Neanderthal water falls into an ocean of human water, the ocean barely changes, but the cup is consumed.
That is one possibility. Another hypothesis is biological bias in mate choice, or even biological incompatibilities that made certain hybrid pairings less viable.
Okay, but what else?
The most intriguing hypothesis, and the one that fundamentally changes how we view their extinction, is social. What if the hybrid children born of these interspecies interactions were culturally and demographically incorporated exclusively into the modern human groups?
Let me push on the implications of that, because it is staggering.
Go ahead.
If a Neanderthal and a modern human have a child, and that hybrid child is raised by the human tribe, and then that child grows up and has their own children within the human tribe, the Neanderthal community gains absolutely zero genetic material from the interaction.
Exactly. The human DNA never enters the Neanderthal gene pool because the hybrids never return to the Neanderthal group.
Which means the human populations are essentially functioning as a demographic vacuum. If the hybrids only go to the human camp, the Neanderthal communities aren't shrinking because they are biologically failing, or because they are starving, or because their genetics are deteriorating. They are shrinking because their reproductive future is literally walking away to join the human population.
It forces a profound shift in how we interpret their final days. If their genetic legacy is continually being funneled into the expanding wave of modern humans, the local isolated Neanderthal communities would inevitably dwindle.
They would simply run out of people.
Yes. The pure Neanderthal phenotype would disappear from the landscape, but their genes wouldn't have been extinguished. They would have just been relocated.
This entire journey is absolutely breathtaking. We started with literal microscopic dust scraped from bones that were butchered, cannibalized, and then blown up by dynamite in the 19th century.
Quite a starting point.
We saw how scientists circumvented 90% modern contamination using bleach baths and silica membranes. We explored how they used the chemistry of decay, the C-T deamination, as a molecular timestamp to prove antiquity.
And we saw how Archaea Plus molecular magnets pulled the Neanderthal needles from the environmental haystack.
Exactly. And the data they retrieved with those tools dismantled a century of archaeological assumptions. They used Ki-32 to override the physical morphology of the bones, reassembling shattered individuals.
And in doing so, they revealed that Europe's last Neanderthals were not doomed. Highly inbred loners shivering in isolated caves. They were a dynamic, interconnected network of communities constantly shifting with the climate, maintaining a healthy genetic diversity right up until the end.
They didn't fade away from genetic decay. Their engine didn't rust. Which leaves us with a final and honestly somewhat uncomfortable thought to mull over.
What's that?
If these late Neanderthals were genetically healthy, and if the extreme asymmetry in the genetic record suggests that their hybrid offspring were systematically absorbed into the massive expanding wave of modern humanity, maybe we need to completely redefine the word extinction.
We traditionally view extinction as an absolute failure, a biological dead end, a species unable to adapt, relegated to the fossil record.
Right, they just failed.
But what if the Neanderthals didn't actually die out in that traditional sense? What if their thriving, interconnected networks were simply demographically swallowed whole by our own expansion?
What if their ultimate survival strategy wasn't a failure at all, but rather an evolution into becoming a permanent, living part of us.
It's a powerful way to look at it.
Their legacy isn't just in the dust of the Muse Basin. It is literally written into the DNA inside your own cells right now. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Keep questioning the past, because clearly the dust has a lot more to say than we ever imagined.